16. On the day when the sheriff brought Goodwin to town, there was a Negro murderer in the jail who had killed his wife, slashed her throat with a razor so that, her whole head tossing further and further backward from the bloody regurgitation of her bubbling throat, she ran out the cabin door and for 6 or 7 steps up the quiet moonlit lane. He would lean in the window in the evening and sing. After supper, a few Negroes gathered along the fence below, natty, shoddy suits and sweat-stained overalls shoulder to shoulder, and in chorus with the murderer, they sang spirituals while white people slowed and stopped in the leaf darkness that was almost summer to listen to those who were sure to die, and him who was already dead, singing about heaven and being tired. Or perhaps in the interval between songs, a rich, sourceless voice coming out of the high darkness where the ragged shadow of the heaven tree which snooted the street lamp at the corner fretted and mourned, 4 days more, then they got destroyed the best baritone singer in North Mississippi. Sometimes during the day he would lean there, singing alone then, though after a while one or two ragamuffin boys, or Negroes with delivery baskets, like as not, would halt at the fence, and the white men sitting in tilted chairs along the oil-foul wall of the garage across the street would listen above their steady jaws. 1 day more, then I's a gone poor son and bitch. Say, ain't no place for you in heaven. Say, ain't no place for you in hell. Say, ain't no place for you in jail. Damn that fella, Goodwin said, jerking up his black head, his gaunt, brown, faintly harried face. I ain't in any position to wish any man that sort of luck, but I'll be damned. He wouldn't talk. I didn't do it. You know that yourself. You know I wouldn't have. I ain't going to say what I think. I didn't do it. They've got to hang it on me first. Let them do that. I'm clear. But if I talk, if I say what I think or believe, I won't be clear. He was sitting on the cot in his cell. He looked up at the windows, 2 orifices not much larger than saber slashes. Is he that good a shot, Benbow said, to hit a man through one of those windows? Goodwin looked at him. Who? Popeye, Benbow said. Did Popeye do it? Goodwin said. Didn't he? Benbow said. I've told all I'm going to tell. I don't have to clear myself. It's up to them to hang it on me. Then what do you want with a lawyer? Benbow said. What do you want me to do? Goodwin was not looking at him. If you'll just promise to get the kid a good newspaper grift when he's big enough to make change, he said, Ruby'll be all right. Won't you, old gal? He put his hand on the woman's head, scouring her hair with his hand. She sat on the cot beside him, holding the child on her lap. It lay in a sort of drugged immobility, like the children which beggars on Paris streets carry, its pinched face slick with faint moisture, its hair a damp whisper of shadow across its gaunt, veined skull, a thin crescent of white showing beneath its lead-colored eyelids. The woman wore a dress of gray crepe, neatly brushed and skillfully darned by hand. Parallel with each seam was that faint, narrow, glazed imprint which another woman would recognize at 100 yards with one glance. On the shoulder was a purple ornament of the sort that may be bought in 10-cent stores or by mail order. On the cot beside her lay a gray hat with a neatly darned veil. Looking at it, Benbow could not remember when he had seen one before, when women ceased to wear veils. He took the woman to his house. They walked, she carrying the child while Benbow carried a bottle of milk and a few groceries, food in tin cans. The child still slept. Maybe you hold it too much, he said. Suppose we get a nurse for it. He left her at the house and returned to town, to a telephone, and he telephoned out to his sister's for the car. The car came for him. He told his sister and Miss Jenny about the case over the supper table. "You're just meddling," his sister said, her serene face, her voice furious. "When you took another man's wife and child away from him, I thought it was dreadful. But I said, at least he will not have the face to ever come back here again. And when you just walked out of the house like a nigger and left her, I thought that was dreadful, too. But I would not let myself believe you meant to leave her for good. And then when you insisted without any reason at all on leaving here and opening the house, scrubbing it yourself and all the town looking on, and living there like a tramp, refusing to stay here where everybody would expect you to stay, and think it funny when you wouldn't. And now to deliberately mix yourself up with a woman you said yourself was a streetwalker, a murderer's woman. I can't help it. She has nothing, no one. In a made-over dress, all neatly about 5 years out of mode, and that child that never has been more than half alive, wrapped in a piece of blanket scrubbed almost cotton white, asking nothing of anyone except to be let alone. Trying to make something out of her life when all you sheltered, chaste women. Do you mean to say a moonshiner hasn't got the money to hire the best lawyer in the country? Miss Jenny said. It's not that, Horace said. I'm sure he could get a better lawyer. It's that, Horace, his sister said. She had been watching him. Where is that woman? Miss Jenny was watching him, too, sitting a little forward in the wheelchair. Did you take that woman into my house? It's my house, too, honey. She did not know that for 10 years he had been lying to his wife in order to pay interest on a mortgage on the stucco house he had built for her in Kinston, so that his sister might not rent to strangers that other house in Jefferson, which his wife did not know he still owned any share in. As long as it's vacant. And with that child, the house where my father and mother and your father and mother, the house where I won't have it. I won't have it. Just for one night, then. I'll take her to the hotel in the morning. Think of her alone with that baby. Suppose it were you and Bory, and your husband accused of a murder you knew he didn't. I don't want to think about her. I wish I had never heard of the whole thing. To think that my brother... Don't you see that you are always having to clean up after yourself? It's not that there's litter left. It's that you... That... But to bring a streetwalker, a murderess, into the house where I was born... Fiddlesticks, Miss Jenny said. But, Horace, ain't that what the lawyers call collusion? Connivance?
Horace looked at her.
It seems to me you've already had a little more to do with these folks than the lawyer in the case should have. You were out there where it happened yourself not long ago. Folks might begin to think you know more than you've told.
That's so, Horace said, Mrs. Blackstone. And sometimes I have wondered why I haven't got rich at the law. Maybe I will when I get old enough to attend the same law school you did.
If I were you, Miss Jenny said, I'd drive back to town now and take her to the hotel and get her settled. It's not late.
And go on back to Kinston until the whole thing is over, Narcissa said. These people are not your people. Why must you do such things?
I cannot stand idly by and see injustice... You won't ever catch up with injustice, Horace, Miss Jenny said.
Well, that irony which lurks in events, then. Miss Jenny said.
It must be because she is one woman you know that don't know anything about that shrimp.
Anyway, I've talked too much, as usual, Horace said. So I'll have to trust you all.
Fiddlesticks, Miss Jenny said. Do you think Narcissa'd want anybody to know that any of her folks could know people that would do anything as natural as make love or rob or steal?
There was that quality about his sister. During all the 4 days between Kinston and Jefferson, he had counted on that imperviousness. He hadn't expected her, any woman, to bother very much over a man she had neither married nor born, when she had one she did bear to cherish and fret over. But he had expected that imperviousness, since she had had it 36 years. When he reached the house in town, a light burned in one room. He entered, crossing floors which he had scrubbed himself, revealing at the time no more skill with the mop than he had expected. Then he had, with the lost hammer with which he nailed the windows down and the shutters too 10 years ago, who could not even learn to drive a motor car. But that was 10 years ago, the hammer replaced by the new one with which he had drawn the clumsy nails, the windows open upon scrubbed floor spaces still as dead pools within the ghostly embrace of hooded furniture. The woman was still up, dressed save for the hat. It lay on the bed where the child slept. Lying together there, they lent to the room a quality of transience more unmistakable than the makeshift light, the smug paradox of the made bed in a room otherwise redolent of long unoccupation. It was as though femininity were a current running through a wire along which a certain number of identical bulbs were hung. "I've got some things in the kitchen," she said. "I won't be but a minute." The child lay on the bed beneath the unshaded light, and he wondered why women in quitting a house will remove all the lampshades, even though they touch nothing else. Looking down at the child, at its bluish eyelids showing a faint crescent of bluish white against its lead-colored cheeks, the moist shadow of hair capping its skull, its hands uplifted, curl-palmed, sweating too, thinking, "Good God. Good God." He was thinking of the first time he had seen it, lying in a wooden box behind the stove in that ruined house 12 miles from town. Of Popeye's black presence lying upon the house like the shadow of something no larger than a match, falling monstrous and portentous upon something else otherwise familiar and everyday and 20 times its size. Of the two of them, himself and the woman, in the kitchen lighted by a cracked and smutty lamp on a table of clean Spartan dishes, and Goodwin and Popeye somewhere in the outer darkness, peaceful with insects and frogs, yet filled too with Popeye's presence in black and nameless threat. The woman drew the box out from behind the stove and stood above it, her hands still hidden in her shapeless garment. "I have to keep him in this so the rats can't get to him," she said. "Oh," Horace said, "you have a son." Then she showed him her hands, flung them out in a gesture at once spontaneous and diffident and self-conscious and proud, and told him he might bring her an orange stick. She returned, with something wrapped discreetly in a piece of newspaper. He knew that it was a diaper, freshly washed, even before she said, "I made a fire in the stove. I guess I overstepped." "Of course not," he said. "It's merely a matter of legal precaution, you see," he said. "Better to put everybody to a little temporary discomfort than to jeopardize our case." She did not appear to be listening. She spread the blanket on the bed and lifted the child onto it. "You understand how it is," Horace said. "If the judge suspected that I knew more about it than the facts would warrant, I mean, we must try to give everybody the idea that holding Lee for that killing is just—" "Do you live in Jefferson?" she said, wrapping the blanket about the child. "No, I live in Kinston. I used to. I have practiced here, though."
"You have kinfolks here, though. Women. That used to live in this house."
She lifted the child, tucking the blanket about it. Then she looked at him.
"It's all right. I know how it is. You've been kind."
"Damn it," he said.
"Do you think—"
"Come on. Let's go on to the hotel. You get a good night's rest, and I'll be in early in the morning. Let me take it."
"I've got him," she said.
She started to say something else, looking at him quietly for a moment, but she went on.
He turned out the light and followed and locked the door. She was already in the car. He got in.
"Hotel, Isom," he said. "I never did learn to drive one," he said. "Sometimes when I think of all the time I have spent not learning to do things."
The street was narrow, quiet. It was paved now, though he could remember when, after a rain, it had been a canal of blackish substance, half earth, half water, with murmuring gutters in which he and Narcissa paddled and splashed with tucked-up garments and muddy bottoms after the crudest of whittled boats. Or made loblollies by treading and treading in one spot with the intense oblivion of alchemists. He could remember when, innocent of concrete, the street was bordered on either side by paths of red brick, tediously and unevenly laid, and worn in rich, random, maroon mosaic into the black earth, which the noon sun never reached. At that moment, pressed into the concrete near the entrance of the drive, were the prints of his and his sister's naked feet in the artificial stone. The infrequent lamps mounted to crescendo beneath the arcade of a filling station at the corner. The woman leaned suddenly forward.
"Stop here, please, boy," she said.
Isom put on the brakes.
"I'll get out here and walk," she said.
"You'll do nothing of the kind," Horace said.
"Go on, Isom."
"No, wait," the woman said.
"We'll be passing people that know you. And then the square."
"Nonsense," Horace said.
"Go on, Isom."
"You get out and wait then," she said.
"He can come straight back."
"You'll do no such thing," Horace said.
"By heaven, I... Drive on, Isom."
"You'd better," the woman said. She sat back in the seat. Then she leaned forward again.
"Listen, you've been kind. You mean all right, but..."
"You don't think I am lawyer enough, you mean?"
"I guess I've got just what was coming to me. There's no use fighting it."
"Certainly not, if you feel that way about it. But you don't, or you'd have told Isom to drive you to the railroad station, wouldn't you?" She was looking down at the child, fretting the blanket about its face. "You get a good night's rest, and I'll be in early tomorrow." They passed the jail, a square building slashed harshly by pale slits of light. Only the central window was wide enough to be called a window, crisscrossed by slender bars. In it, the Negro murderer leaned. Below, along the fence, a row of heads, hatted and bare above work-thickened shoulders, and the blended voices swelled rich and sad into the soft, depthless evening, singing of heaven and being tired. "Don't you worry at all now. Everybody knows Lee didn't do it." They drew up to the hotel, where the drummers sat in chairs along the curb, listening to the singing.
"I must," the woman said.
Horace got down and held the door open. She didn't move.
"Listen, I've got to tell..."
"Yes," Horace said, extending his hand. "I know. I'll be in early tomorrow." He helped her down. They entered the hotel, the drummers turning to watch her legs, and went to the desk. The singing followed them, dimmed by the walls, the lights. The woman stood quietly nearby, holding the child, until Horace had done.
"Listen," she said.
The porter went on with the key toward the stairs. Horace touched her arm, turning her that way.
"I've got to tell you," she said.
"In the morning," he said.
"I'll be in early," he said,
guiding her toward the stairs. Still, she hung back, looking at him. Then she freed her arm by turning to face him.
"All right, then," she said.
She said in a low, level tone, her face bent a little toward the child.
"We haven't got any money. I'll tell you now. That last batch Papa didn't..."
"Yes, yes," Horace said. "First thing in the morning. I'll be in by the time you finish breakfast. Good night." He returned to the car, into the sound of the singing.
"Home, Isom," he said.
They turned and passed the jail again,
and the leaning shape beyond the bars and the heads along the fence. Upon the barred and slitted wall, the splotched shadow of the heaven tree shuddered and pulsed monstrously in scarce any wind. Rich and sad, the singing fell behind. The car went on, smooth and swift, passing the narrow street.
"Here," Horace said. "Where are you?"
Isom clapped on the brakes.
"Miss Narcissus said to bring you back out home," he said.
"Oh, she did," Horace said. "That was kind of her. You can tell her I changed her mind."
Isom backed and turned into the narrow street and then into the cedar drive, the lights lifting and boring ahead into the unpruned tunnel, as though into the most profound blackness of the sea. As though among straying, rigid shapes to which not even light could give color. The car stopped at the door, and Horace got out.
"You might tell her it was not to her I ran," he said. "Can you remember that?"